But this lesson, I love this lesson this week. Jesus, the Master Teacher. Tell me your own experience of teachers in your life. Did anybody have anything that has impacted you that still's with you from a teacher in your life? Go ahead.
I had a teacher in high school that when I first went into his class, he said, "You know, I've taught your brother and your older sister, and the pressure's on." But that was one of the most valuable teachers in my life. He was quite a philosopher, mm-hmm. and always had these sayings about, about things in philosophy. But my senior year, I missed 6 weeks of school with a problem with ear infection that would go from one ear to the other. And I tried to go back to school after 5 weeks and had a relapse. Mm-hmm. And so the teachers felt like I had missed, well, there was one teacher in particular that I had missed so much school that they did not want me to graduate. And he stood up for me and he says, "That boy is an A-plus student. You're not going to do that to him."
Wow.
But she did make me gave me a makeup assignment, which I completed before I graduated.
So that teacher stood up for you. That teacher went the extra mile and said, "I'm going to do something because you're not going to do that."
He was an amazing person.
And how many years ago was that? not to date him. Just a few years ago. Well, you know, what I want to really get the realization of, those kinds of experiences, when you talk about it, it's like you're right back there and you still feel that specialness of that teacher. You still feel that. Now, that teacher, we can assume, is long dead. But that teacher lives in that reality. Who else? Anybody else have a quick experience you'd like to share?
When I was in eighth grade in Baton Rouge, didn't have any money, of course. And there was somebody in that church, the teacher talked about for me to send me to Gentry, Arkansas.
Wow. Golly, that teacher recommended that. That's neat. Go ahead.
When I was in academy, Valley Grand Academy, right at the end of my senior year, there were several students that were that we had learned received Social Security benefits for being for death benefits, and I was one of them along with five others. And that program was getting phased out. And so one of the administrators there contacted the Keene University administration. And they were able to put together a class that was right before the deadline so that we could continue to get our benefits.
Wow.
And there were five or six of us that came up to Keene to do this, and the class that was created for us was taught by Rob Shepard.
Oh, interesting.
It was Life and Teachings in Christ. And the reason I'm sharing this is not because it's associated with Rob so much, but it's because really, honestly, for the time that I was all through academy and church school and so forth, I'd always learned, you know, Bible teachings, Adventist teachings, and so forth. That class was the first class where I was taught the love of Christ in the way that Rob teaches it, even to this day. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting. It was based on the desire of ages. Mm-hmm. And I'd never heard teaching like that in all of my 18 years as growing up. And so that was real impactful.
Okay. Who else? I saw someone else.
I grew up in Tyler, and I had a history teacher who was passionate about the Civil War, but he couldn't teach it. The Robert E. Lee High School that I went to, not allowing him to teach the Civil War. So I took honors American history with them. It started with Reconstruction, and he had a unique approach where we all were senators from various states that were involved with Reconstruction, and we were debating, you know, what should be done with the South after the Civil War. So in a way, he did that so that we would study the Civil War on our own and understand more about Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. But I was forced in my senior year to get picked on a cannon crew. He was the sponsor for the symbolic cannon that he had, the Civil War cannon. And we would, in the summertime, when we trained on his farm, and we would travel the South and perform at battlefields at Vicksburg, and Shiloh, Stone Mountain, Georgia, and so forth. And so when we went to those battle parks, he stood out there and started telling us about how the battle unfolded. And I mean, you could visualize exactly what had transpired 150 years before from the way he described it, you know. And so he really, I loved history, but not, you know, military history, World War II and so forth. He really gave me an appreciation for the Civil War, and he'll stick with me forever.
Okay. Anybody else? I don't want to leave anybody out. But you think about these experiences we're talking about. Now, I didn't hear anybody say, oh, I had this great teacher and I learned this great math concept. Why not? You know, Rick talked more specifically about learning about the love of Christ through the class with Rob. But, you know, it's interesting to think about how a teacher is really one that invests and you feel somehow you're connected to them. And they do something to change, alter your life experience. Peggy, that experience that you talked about, it altered your life experience. It changed something. Something happened that was different. It changed your perspective. Now, that teacher that stood up for you there, he altered your life experience. And that then became permanently part of it. And usually, if we're talking about experience of remembering a teacher, it's because that experience then changed your view of things. Suddenly, teacher took on a new meaning. It was a person. It was somebody that stood up. Somebody that came and did something different. Somebody that recommended somebody. Somebody made something come to life. Where before it was just one-dimensional. Now it's three-dimensional. And you think about Jesus, the master teacher. That's what he came to do to this world. Change that whole dynamic of understanding God. You've seen me, you've seen the Father. Wow, that was quite a thing. I mean, how many times do you say, oh God, if we could just get a vision of you, get an idea of you. Well, Jesus came and did that. And what's interesting in studying Luke, and we got to remember a few things about Luke. Who's Luke talking to? Who's Luke's audience mainly? The Gentiles. He doesn't go through the history and trying to tie Jesus to some of the history. He goes back to talking about the history of Adam and Eve and up, but he's not interested in just trying to document it for the Jewish people. He himself did not observe these things, so he went and had to get eyewitnesses. He went out and studied. He himself a Gentile. So there's some interesting things about Luke. And how Luke, the story that Ernie talked about last week, the only place it's found is in Luke. And yet, you look at that story and it encompasses all of what the message about God is. Well, today, part of the lesson is the Sermon on the Mount is found in Luke. Now, once again, we have to remember the context of Luke. The Sermon on the Mount was one of those things that really altered your perspective. It really changed the dynamic of how you saw things. And that's why, and that's what a good teacher does. A good teacher, one that somehow stimulates you to start looking at things a little differently. You know, it's not knowing 2 plus 2 equals 4. That's not how you learn. It's that 2 plus 2, and when you put 5, you realize it's not 5, it's 4. Oh, and so it's those things that alter our perspective. And as we know, the Sermon on the Mount really was trying to help change that whole perspective that the Pharisees, the Jewish people had. What did they basically have understanding? If you're doing well, if you're financially prospering, you're being blessed by God. If you're everything's going well in your life, you're being blessed. If you have illness, if you have disease, if you have a problem, if you're somehow you're not in line with God, you somehow have lost the way. Now, you can see where they would come to that conclusion. That's one of the most interesting things. And as a therapist, I'm always fascinated by how do we come to the conclusions that we come to. You look about the history of the children of Israel. And from a very flat kind of perspective, one-dimensional, you can look at how they came to those conclusions. We were idolaters. We did this, and then we went to captivity. And you could see all of the things that led them to where they came to the conclusions they did. And I tell you that during the time Jesus came, they were the best Seventh-day Adventists that ever existed. But as we all know in history, as Ellen White talked about, it's the darkest time in history. The darkest because they so lost the understanding. So Jesus comes to turn that upside down. I've been reading a book by George Knight about the history and perspective of Adventism. And it's fascinating to read about this from a historical perspective, from his research, and to realize how I can see why we've come to some of the conclusions in Adventism that we have. During the 30s and 40s, the M.L. Andreessen, I believe, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing right, was a leading theologian. And the idea that he understood was the end of time is about those that keep his commandments and perfect it. Where did we hear that from? The Pharisees. That was their belief. We've had these bad things happen. We've got to now figure out how to never let it happen again. Well, in the interpretations of going in theological circles in the 20s and 30s and 40s, I'm not sure about all my dates, but I've been reading this book, but it's talked about that was the predominant idea. And it really got to the point where it wasn't more about Christ, it was about us and what we do. It wasn't about the relationship, it was about how we perfect it in ourselves and then present it, and then God can say to the devil, look at these people, look at what they've done. They've proven it. And you know what's been fascinating for me is, in reading this, it's helped me to have more understanding of what I came through as a young person in the Adventist system. Because I remember so distinctly that experience of, they seemed more concerned about how long my hair was than anything else. They seemed more concerned about how long the dresses were. My grandmother, I've told the story several times, would tell me, oh, I just cannot believe these kids today. Pretty soon the girls are just going to be wearing belts. That's during the miniskirt era, you know. Well, to me as a 15-year-old, I'm thinking, go for it, you know. But to her, it was a frightening thing. Well, think about it. She grew up during that time period where this theology was being presented. And to her, it was fear. It was frightening to think about these behaviors that she exhibited because that meant they were lost. What's the common thing you hear? Oh, my son or daughter's left the church. And that kind of idea is somehow in like they're lost instead of they're not a part of this group. Go ahead.
Is your microphone working? My hearing aids just went out. I can't hear what you're saying.
Is my microphone working?
Yeah, it's not working.
Oh.
Loud enough for me.
Well, I'll try to talk as loud as I can, okay? So what we have to remember is understanding the mindset. When I read this about Adventism, and then I think about my own experience growing up, and then I look at my grandmother and her experience, it kind of, you can see how it fits together. But once again, as in Jesus' time, we have to be open to having our beliefs challenged. And that's what Jesus, the Master Teacher, did. It's interesting. We're not going to read through all the Sermon on the Mount, but in Luke chapter 6, talks about some of the ideas here. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. But I say to you, who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Do you know how hard that is? Now, we could do it on a behavioral sense. We could say, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is what my task is. This is what is written in Luke. So I've got to figure out how to do this. But you know, that's the challenge of any of these kind of ideas. We somehow figure out it's something we've got to do instead of what's the relationship? What kind of relationship do you have with a loving God that allows you to be in this place? Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also, and whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. You just shook your head when you said that. What was that about? You don't think you could do that. And you see, what this does is sometimes it challenges, and if we don't focus on the relationship and understanding what this, the relationship that God wants us to have with Him and with each other, it becomes something that we think we have to do. It's interesting to think about how different people in history have taken these words and they've literally given away everything and have lived some miserable life. And yet, it's not doing of this thing, it's the understanding of this thing. It doesn't mean not doing. I'm not saying that. Let's go on and read here. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. So like Sue, let's have our bottles of water ready so we can pass out. We're always ready to give. And just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. And if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. But if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For He Himself is kind to the ungrateful and evil man. And when I read He Himself, it's capitalized, meaning God. You think about it. The sun shines in the evil and the good people. God doesn't withhold a thing. So really, Jesus was, as the Master Teacher, was trying to say, let's get an understanding of who your Father is. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. And do not judge, and you will not be judged. And do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Pardon, and you will be pardoned. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, they will pour into your lap. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. And he also spoke a parable to them. A blind man cannot guide a blind man, can he? Will they both fall into a pit? A pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone, after he has been fully trained, will be like his teacher. Think of those words. Everyone who's fully trained will be like his teacher. Think of the short little stories we had about teachers this morning. Don't you think that inspires you to do some of the things that people have done for you? Don't you want to stand up for somebody that's could be victimized? Don't you want to contribute to something that somebody will gain from and it will keep a rippling effect? To me, that's the exciting part of what Jesus is talking about, is he's really understanding this is really who your Father is. And I think sometimes that's the biggest thing we have to remember, is we read this and we think, oh, it's something I've got to do. Instead of, oh, it's the result of understanding and loving my Father. That's why what Ernie and Rob do when they go out to these churches is so important. It's the understanding of the love. And then what happens? The behavior changes. Then we shake our head and say, oh, how could I do anything else? How could I do anything else? Then others... parable I want to get to in here, and this is once again the only one from what I remember is found in Luke, and that's the Good Samaritan. Let's go to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. Would somebody look up Numbers 19, 11 through 13? Somebody just get that and hold it. So we're going to look at the parable here in Luke chapter 8, starting at 48. Let me see, maybe I'm... No. I got the wrong thing here. I think it is in 10. I wrote down... let me find it here.
The Good Samaritan starts at verse 30 and 10.
Yeah, there we go. So we're going to start at verse 25. Now remember, master teachers, they challenge a perspective. They add dimension to it. And in this experience, they're adding a perspective. So it starts out here, and behold, a certain lawyer, here we got a lawyer story, stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Now, that's a classic question. Is it really a question? Do you think they want to know the answer? Don't you often have people, especially lawyers, ask a question, but they already are trying to steer your answer? I had the opportunity to be deposed on the phone the other day, and it was about a case from 3 years ago, and you just feel like you're being led down to slaughter, and the attorney that deposed me was the attorney for the representing the other side, and it was a case involving an accident where they were trying to get money for this accident that occurred, and I saw the kid 3 times. And I just felt like, whoa, where are we going here? And at one point he talked about what was my diagnosis and did I diagnose. And, you know, I looked through the file and thought I read it thoroughly. And then I realized, I told him, no, I didn't diagnose because it was being paid by the attorney. And, you know, I didn't need to formally go into that process. And then I realized I had diagnosed. And where do you stop and say, whoops, misstep here? So I just said, well, I misspoke. Let me rephrase what I'm saying. So here this lawyer stands up, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, now this is a masterful answer. What is written in the law? How does it read to you? What is written in the law? How does it read to you? Once again, as a master teacher, it's more important to understand the conclusions that person has versus, because I can sit up here and I can lecture about something, but if I don't understand what that individual who I'm trying to teach understands or has an image of, it's going to probably be for naught. And he answered and said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself. That's a pretty good answer, wasn't it? It's a great answer. And Jesus said to him, you have answered correctly. Don't you like it when you get the answer right? You've answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But you know, as lawyers, they don't know how to let things go. Do this and you will live. But wishing to justify, he said to Jesus, now this is a lawyer, they've always got to justify. We always want to make sure it's right. And who is my neighbor? Boy, what an opportunity there. What an opportunity to get a new perspective. See, this lawyer knew the words to say. He knew how to present the information. But now he was going to get a life-altering experience. We call those teachable moments. You all have those kind of moments in life with people, whether it be you're in the process of teaching or someone's doing that with you. Who is my neighbor? Jesus replied and said, a certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, and they stripped him and beat him and went off, leaving him half dead. Now, just a little geography lesson here. Jerusalem is about, I think, 2,400 feet above sea level. Jericho is about 1,300 feet. So together, they're about 3,600, 3,700 feet between them. Have you ever gone on a road down a hill or up a hill? It tends to wind. Not straight. Why not? It tends to wind around. And this is well known. Another master teacher. They take information from where they're at and relate it to a bigger principle. They take where they're at. And so this story he was telling, people knew about that. Even into the early 1900s, there's stories about this road. It was well understood that that was a dangerous place to travel. Now, if you have some understanding of that, this story makes even more intense and draws out more meaning, because it adds to understanding of something we already know. Now, what can we know about the person that got beat up? What do we know about him? What? Person that was beat up? No, I don't know if he's Samaritan. He was alone. Is that a smart thing to do on a dangerous road? I mean, you can say, people that drive through water, well, they get what they deserve. Why'd they do that? That was a stupid thing. So this individual who got beat up, we could simply say to him, he got what he deserved. Well, as a teenager, I drove through water and drowned a car. So I look upon that totally different. Totally different. I remember that experience of wanting to get to see this girl I was going to see. And seeing that university and that water, and I thought, I think I can make it. I didn't make it. So I had understanding when I see those people sitting there with their cars drowning, thinking, I think I can do it. I think I just got to get there. We don't know why this man was doing what he was doing. But he was traveling alone in a known dangerous area. Maybe he was urgently going to do something. Maybe he was felt compelled. But he was traveling alone. And by chance, now this is an interesting way of saying it. By chance, a certain priest was going down on that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. The priest passed by on the other side. Don't you feel that way? Oh, I just got to get away from this. Oof. I understand that feeling too. Did someone look up numbers for me? Go ahead. 11 through 13. Numbers 19, 11 through 13.
He who touches the dead body of anyone shall be unclean 7 days. He shall purify himself with water on the third day, and then on the seventh, Then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. He whoever touches the body of anyone who has died shall not be pure. Does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord. The person shall be cut off from Israel. He shall be unclean because the water of purification was not sprinkled on him. His uncleanliness.
You think it.
When a man dies in
the tent. So you think of that. This priest had good reason to avoid that person over there. It was job security issues. I can't get over there. If I get over there, something may happen and that person may be dead, and if I touch him, everything is messed up. You know, the priests were divided into groups and they had certain weeks they were doing their services, and that was a highlight. That was something they looked forward to. All of the different structure and things they did were so important. And they valued it. You know, I think oftentimes of that tomb, at the tomb of the unknown soldier, and as we speak right now, there's somebody marching there. And part of me, when I see that, because of who I am, thinking, oh, could we just say someone's doing it and not do it? But right now, there's somebody marching at that tomb of unknown soldier every moment. 24 hours a day. What's the significance of that to that person doing it? What's the significance of those people that come to visit it? It has a lot of significance. When you go there, it's rather, it's kind of intriguing and inspiring. Well, this priest maybe thought of that the same way. This priest may have come to the recognition of, wow, I cannot take that risk. So the priest had some good legitimate reasons maybe not to do what he was to go on by, to hurry. Because it could really endanger some other things in his life that he thought was more important than that person lying there. And you know, we always can come to a conclusion once we need to decide not to do something. Well, you know, who knows? That man deserved it anyway. He was out here by himself. So, we go on here. And likewise, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. One part of the story talks about him going over and looking the Levi. So maybe he got a little more intrigued, but then decided he better get by. Once again, we don't understand what the conclusion that man came to or why he decided he had to pass by. But he went on by. But a certain Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion. Now, just in the way Jesus is telling the story, he felt compassion. Don't you want, when you're in a distress, someone that has compassion? Carol and I interviewed a person yesterday for a secretarial job at our counseling center, and I said to this person, "You're the first person these people have contact with, and what you do is more important almost than what I do. Because if they don't have a good experience when they call, when you take that initial phone call, it's going to be, they may not come in." This Samaritan had compassion. I know in my life, when I've needed, felt most distressed, I wanted people to have compassion. I wanted a teacher who would stand up for me. I want a teacher that recommend me to get financial assistance so I could do something. I want individuals who come along and show new things to me. Because truthfully, it's when we're the most distressed and hurting is sometimes when we're the most ready to learn new things. And that's the kind of person that I think we're called to be. And he came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. Now, he just didn't go and say, "Well, I'll get him to the next town." He took him to the inn. He took care of him. And on the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, "Take care of him. And whatever more you spend when I return, I will repay you." Now here's the question Jesus asked the lawyer. "Which of these 3 do you think proved to the neighbor to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands?" Now you talk about Jesus turning it on the lawyer. "Which of these 3, he said. Now, you know the lawyer might have stumbled over his words, or maybe he said gladly, I don't know. But the key is the Samaritan. Now, one thing about a Samaritan, there's indication it could have been actually Samaritans, or it could have been anybody that the Jewish people decided were not following the way and not doing right, and they were kind of banned. And the fact that this traveler was going from Jerusalem to Jericho indicates that it might have been somebody that had some Jewish connections but had left the church, had been done something horrendous. Because at one point in John, they talked to Jesus about, they accused him of being a Samaritan. So it's not uncommon that this person might not have actually been from Samaria, but because he was not a Jewish, that he was Samaritan. So we don't know that, but there's just speculation about that. But the reality is that man was not considered among the chosen. But he came to the rescue. And the lawyer said, "The one who showed mercy toward him." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do the same." Go and do the same. Now, this story has all kinds of ramifications, has all kinds of things that you can look at in it. We don't know what the priest and the Levite felt toward the man. Maybe they felt compassion. Maybe they thought, oh man, maybe the priest said, I'll get the temple and I'll say a prayer for him. We don't know those things. But it's interesting to think about the difference. They might have had pity toward the man. But pity and feeling compassion without action is nothing. In fact, William Barclay talks about it in the sense of being a sin. Pity which remains merely an emotion is actually a sin, because it's always a sin to experience high emotion and do nothing to turn it into action. Why does Ernie, when he talks about the ministry, why does it mean so much? Because it's where they took ideas and what's happened, understanding he had in his life, and turned it into action. And then you see the results. Barclay talks about this. Emotion can never be a substitute for action. There's a story of a Russian aristocrat lady in the old days who was in a theater watching an intensely moving play and weeping as she watched. She was caught up in this play. Outside, her coachman was slowly freezing to death on the box of her coach, while he had been forbidden to leave until she emerged from the theater. The lady was substituting emotion for action. In the theater, she wallowed in sentimental tears. Outside, there was an opportunity to put that compassion into action, and she was not even aware of that opportunity. That, to me, speaks volume about what this parable's about. That Samaritan person put compassion into action, where the other two had maybe good reasons, but they left the man there. And if nothing else, the Good Samaritan parable is really about the action that we're all going to be judged on. Did you feed me? You clothed me when I was naked. You fed me when I was hungry. Lord, when did we do that? Oh, we have so many opportunities of that in our own life. And I think the parable of the Good Samaritan continues to remind us that it's taking the action. You know, we're called to be compassionate people. But our compassion is realized when we put into action the very things that draw people out. Every one of you that told me about a teacher had somebody that did something to change your life experience. And that's what Jesus, the master teacher, did when he came to this earth. He brought a new understanding. And you know, I compared the Adventist church to the Pharisees. And the beauty about it is, we're not done with the experience of the Adventist church. I just pray and hope that we take that turn, and that we become some of the most compassionate, loving people that will accept anyone into their fellowship, because we want them to understand God's love. That we'll embrace the people that feel scorned by the world. That we'll bring in those that will want to be apart, because we want them to experience the same thing we do. To me, that's the most exciting thing about what I think can happen to us as an organization and as individuals. Shall we pray? Dear God, we're so grateful for the stories of the Good Samaritan, how your Son clearly demonstrated what it means to be like you. May each one of us in our own life take this challenge and to have the compassion and then take the action to express that compassion. And we don't know how it always will be returned or if it will be returned. But we know that we're called to be compassionate people who take action toward others. May each one of us experience the recreation and the restoring of ourselves today, so that we can continue to be the compassionate people you meant for us to be. Thank you in your holy name. Amen.